Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I am joined today for this special episode by a gentleman named Ken Davies. You may pick up on from his accent that he's not from the United States. He is a UK podcaster, and he's taken on the case. This podcast is called The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head. This was recommended to me to check out by some of our listeners, and as soon as I mentioned it, a lot of, especially our UK listeners, got real excited about hearing from Ken. So he's on to tell us all about this case. And Ken, the first question, and then I'll get into kind of your background and stuff, but the first question that popped up in the chat was, for the people that aren't familiar with the case, can we get kind of a Cliff Notes version of what the case is before we dig into what you're doing on the podcast?
Yeah, of course. It all starts on March the 26th, 1971. And so essentially 53 years ago yesterday.
Okay.
And a man's body is found on an island in a river in a very secluded area in this tiny village in the middle of England. Now, that's pretty unusual in its own right, but it isn't really what makes it unusual. What's really strange about this is that body to this day has never been identified who he is. Now, so this person would have been killed 69, 1970, buried, and then was found by accident about 12 months later. What's really unusual is in England, you don't get bodies that don't end up being identified. That just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. You can count the instances of that on one hand for pretty much the whole of the 20th century, because very few people get murdered in the UK, really. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very few people get murdered and then buried on an island in a river, and then an infinitesimally small number end up not either being able to be identified. So what's happened is really the perfect crime, because this man was tied and buried, and 53 years later, we don't even know who he is. And so we definitely don't know who the perpetrators were. So that in a very short synopsis is the case. There are a million of weird things going on around this case as well, which we'll come to, but that's what really is at the root of this whole thing.
So why Fred the Head? Where does that moniker come from?
It's from the police. What happened is, although the body was in complete form, so he wasn't separated, his head wasn't separated from his body in any way when he was murdered, or when he was buried at least, the police separated the head. The forensic pathologist separated the head, and that head was kept in a box in the police offices in Burton-upon-Trent, which is the town closest to the village where this happened. And I happen to know the son of the main investigator of the time in 1970. And this main investor kept the head in a box and took it around with him and showed it to people. So the police, knowing that there was this head in a box in this tiny police station in Burton-upon-Trent, they gave him the name of Fred the Head. And even though clearly it's not his name,
right,
but that's what he's become known as ever since.
So you'd mentioned it. So I had first heard about your podcast 4 or 5 days ago when one of my listeners, you know, we asked for who they'd like to hear from, and they mentioned you. I just started listening to the pod. I thought I'll binge through this real quick before I talk to Ken, and that was super interesting. Then I found out there's 48 episodes of the podcast, so I clearly haven't been through all of it. But from what I heard, it's fascinating. But one question I have, you just mentioned that, so he's found in March of 1971, and you think he was killed like a year or so later, earlier than that. How was it determined, if they don't know who he is, when he was killed?
There are two things that point to that. The body was naked, apart from two things. He had a ring on, mm-hmm. his wedding ring finger, of his right hand, not his left hand. Hmm. So he had a wedding ring on, and he had socks. Okay, the socks were leave to one side for a second, but the ring is interesting because rings are hallmarked. And I used to work in the jewelry industry. I know something about how hallmarks work. And what we know from the hallmarks of that ring is it was made in 1967 or 1968. So
okay.
The second half of 67 or the first half of 68. So we know that he didn't go in there before the last part of 67.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the jewelry industry, that ring has to be made, it has to be hallmarked, it has to go to a retailer, it has to be bought, it has to be worn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably, you know, we know from that direction, it's probably 69, 70 from that direction in terms of the ring and how it was worn and its wear and all those things. But also, when they got the body out from its grave, and there's some weird things about how it was buried, which we'll come to. But when they got the body out and they went through the forensic pathology, they estimated, due to the decomposition of the body, that the body had been in the ground somewhere between 9 and 18 months.
Okay.
Purely from a decompositional perspective. So we've got two things happening here that kind of pinpoint a window, which is really quite narrow, which is the ring, which we know was made when it was made, which points to a 69, 70 kind of burial.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also got the forensic pathology, which is also pointing to the same window from a decompositionary perspective.
Okay. And what we said, we're setting the socks aside. What's the story with the socks?
Well, there's been various stories about the socks, in the sense of the socks were the only... There was only three things with him: the ring, the socks, and rope. He was tied up as well. So we should talk about that as well. But the socks specifically, when I first got to know this story, there was various descriptions of the socks saying they were pink and they were yellow and there were all these weird colors. And too much was made, I think, over the intervening 50 years about the socks and what the socks indicated. I've seen the socks. I've seen a film of the socks. They are the blandest, most boring socks you'll ever see in your life. They're kind of a beigey color. So there was some speculation way back that the socks in some way indicated something about this person's lifestyle. I've lived with this case now for 5 years. I don't buy that, really. I just think they were the most basic pieces of hosiery that you could possibly have.
Okay.
So, but they were there. The interesting thing about the socks is that if this person has been stripped of his clothes, which he had been, or simply didn't have his clothes with him, and one explanation for that could be that his clothes would be an identifier as to who he was, and therefore they had to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
Why did this person not bother to take the socks off? Which is, you know, a good point, and we can talk about that later. So the socks are important because they're there. Do they tell us a great deal about the lifestyle of the individual that was killed? I don't really think so.
Okay. So before we start digging in any further, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, what your background is, and how you got involved with the case and up to creating this podcast?
Well, it was not my intention. In the sense of I wasn't at that point involved in any broadcast media. I was running a company called GSC Media. We were primarily involved in events. So I run big events around the world, including America. And of course, 2020 wasn't a great year for events around the world.
Right.
For one reason or another. So I was kind of kicking my heels in around 2020. And about a year before that, we had moved to a house in a village called Newton Solner, which is the village next to where Fred was found. And I was living right on the edge of that village. So my house was about 250 yards away from the deposition site.
Okay.
And so when I moved there in 2019, I was looking around history of the area. I've always been interested in history. And it's been a place that people have lived on for, you know, thousands of years. The weird thing about the United Kingdom is, you know, everybody has lived on the spot you're living for thousands of years.
Sure.
Well, if you just dig anywhere, you're going to find things from earlier civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been interested in that. I was looking around at the history of this little village called Windshill, which is next to me, came across this story. And I thought, well, that's an interesting story. I wonder what happened to him. Wonder what their circumstances were, who killed him. Did they come to justice? And there was nothing. There was this report of this body found in 71, and then nothing. And then the more I dug into it, the more I realized that 54, or at that time, 48 years later, the police still didn't have anything to go on. So I thought, whoa, that's interesting. I couldn't get it out of my mind. So I read it, put it away, went on with my life, but I couldn't get rid of this case. And I'm not an investigative journalist, but I've done a million interviews with people over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm used to talking to people. And one of the most interesting things about it is the discovery story. So it's found by this man called David Nathan, the skull is. And it's a very weird story in its own right. And I thought David Nathan would probably been passed on. He'd probably passed on by then. But I was talking to a friend of mine, and I mentioned this story that I'd got in my head. And wasn't it weird that no one had ever found out who he was? Found by this man called David Nathan. And this friend of mine said, I know David Nathan, which is really odd. There's no reason why he would. And he said, no, I know him. He's a jeweler. I could put you in contact with him. So I said, okay, give me his number. So I got his number. And then I sat on his number for 3 months. So how am I going to ring a guy who found a dead body 50 years ago and hope to extract from him any kind of interview or conversation? It's the weirdest thing to do, way outside my comfort zone. So anyway, I sat there with this number for 3 months, and people were pestering me saying, ring him. You know, on Friday afternoon, I'd run out of things to do. One Friday, I picked the phone up, rang him, and said, look, you don't know me. My name's Ken Davis. Hope you don't mind me asking, but, you know, I understand it. You found a body 50 years ago. Yeah. I'd really like to talk to you about it. And he was great about it. He said, yeah, what do you want to know? And so we arranged to talk. I recorded it because I knew, I mean, David was an old man then. He's passed on now. I knew this might be the last opportunity anybody ever has of capturing, again, the discovery story from the person who discovered him.
Yeah.
So I recorded it. I had no intention of developing a podcast from it. I was just doing it for my own interest. But I told a lot of people about the story, and the discovery story, as it was told to me by David Nathan, was the weirdest story I'd heard anyway. And a few people, I was a big listener to podcasts. I was into Serial and all these kind of things, as we all were. That's how we all began. And in about 2020, the world changed, didn't it, because of COVID. And someone said to me, do a podcast about it. And I said, no, okay. I've never done one before. I had to learn the technology, as we all did. And I did a podcast. I didn't put it out there. I just let a few people listen to it. Said, look, this is the first episode of a potential podcast about Fred the Head.
Yeah.
And everyone said, tell us when you got number two. Tell us when you've done number two. And from that initial 30 people, it's now a million people. And that's where it started. So it started from me accidentally finding the case, and then accidentally finding the person who found the body. He was happened to be still alive all the time. Of him taking me to the deposition site and walking me through the deposition site. And then COVID. which accidentally made me get into podcasting. COVID hadn't happened, definitely wouldn't have been a podcast.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of great podcasts right now were born from COVID for people that, you know, had nothing else to do.
And for sure. And I would have been too busy. It just wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't busy and therefore it did happen. And I'm very pleased it did now because I ended up doing a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. Now, are you still running the media company and doing the podcast or have you?
Yeah. Oh, the podcast is my hobby.
Okay.
You know, I've got a more than a full-time job running events around the world and running other podcasts with people. Fred is a hobby. It's not a job. Okay. And I don't seek to monetize it in any way. I absolutely get why people do. And, you know, it's important that the work everybody does is monetized. But you know, Fred died. Fred was killed. Fred was buried. I don't want to make a penny out of Fred.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that I do on Fred has always been free. It's not always the case in the other podcasts I've run, but it is on Fred. Everything's available for free to everyone.
That's awesome. So can you, as you said, I kind of cheated when I started listening. I listened to your first couple episodes, and then I jumped to one of your most recent episodes where you kind of recapped one to kind of see where things were at in the investigation. And I got to hear the discovery story kind of twice. But for those that aren't familiar with it, like as you said, it's a peculiar story. Can you explain how the body was discovered?
Essentially, it involves two people, a man called David Nathan, who we talked about earlier, and his business partner, a guy called Garth Hank Gopsall. And they were jewelers, but they were also gunsmiths. That's me, but you know, that's what they did. And they had this tiny little workshop, which was in this village of Winds Hill, which was attached to the house where Garth Hank Gopsall lived. So that's where he lived. And his partner was a man called David Nathan. And what they used to do was occasionally, or fairly regularly, go across a wooden bridge that was locked to go onto this island, a place called Bass's Meadow in Burton-upon-Trent, Winds Hill, and just fire the guns, shoot pigeons, things like that. I mean, it's not a hobby that I'd enjoy, but you know, people do that kind of thing. And one Friday evening, and there's lots of issues on this because David Nathan, the person who found it, said it was 7:30 in the evening. Well, you know, we've established it couldn't have been 7:30 in the evening. So there's some weird things going on with the testimony in terms of timing. But he said it was 7:30 in the evening. So he goes, which is dark, so it makes no sense. So he goes out at 7:30 in the evening, of course, according to David, on his own, unlocks the bridge, which he had the key to, goes across the bridge into this small area, which used to be tens of years ago, in the 1930s and 40s, used to be a flint mill. So it was like a small processing factory. It had, you know, a few little buildings here, but it was long demolished and long gone. So he was walking across that, up a rise, and he was going up a rise, and the top of this rise is where he used to shoot the pigeons because it was the best, his best viewpoint, really. And he noticed something in the ground. He said he noticed a small, like an upturned saucer, and he saw it out the corner of his eye. And then he went and did his thing and came back and was curious still about this thing. So he hit it with the butt of the gun and he said it sounded hollow. So he thought, well, that's odd. So he went back to the house, got a spade, dug around it, realized it was a skull. Now, skulls do appear around this place around this general area because, you know, people have been living there since Viking times.
Right.
Repton, which is 2 miles away, was the capital of Mercia. You know, we are talking you know, in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And so there are people who've been living there for 1,000 years, Vikings who are living there. So it could have been an old skull. Does a bit of digging, sees the skull. He does not ring the police. Now, which is odd, because he's a police reservist. He knows everyone in the police.
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't ring the police. He rings his partner, Gotham Gopsall. Gotham Gopsall is not in his house. He's gone to teach shooting to the scouts at a local school. When I say local, I mean literally around the corner. It's about 0.5 mile away. But of course, this wasn't mobile phone time, 1971. So he has to ring the school at about 7:30 on Friday night when there's no one there and get a message to Gotham Gopsall, who's teaching the kids to shoot. And whatever that message was, Garth said, right, I'm coming straight back. Don't do anything. I'm coming straight back. Garth jumps in his car, drives back to his house, and joins David looking at this skull. And they dig a bit further. So they still haven't called the police. And this is an hour or so after he's found the body. And he digs around, and they notice something pink in the mouth. They think it's his tongue, probably his denture that was in still. So at that point, where now it must be an hour and a half since the original discovery, then they ring the police. But they don't ring what you'd say 911, we'd say 999 in the UK to get the emergency services. I found a dead body, what you'll do. They ring a friend who happens to be in the Burton police and say, you're never going to believe this, but we found a body. And then the police descend on the scene. Now, one of the curious things about the whole discovery story is why David Nathan needed to ring Garth Hank Gopsall at all. Because this skull is not found on Garth Hank Gopsall's land.
Mm-hmm.
It's not owned. That land is not owned by Garth, although he lives close to it. It's owned by a mill, an old flour mill that was still in operation at that time. So actually, it's got nothing to do with Garth. But David rings Garth and says, "Garth, I found a body. Don't do anything. Let's get back." Garth comes back, and then they ring the police, and then the official investigation starts to take place. So that was the story that David Nathan told me in that first conversation with him. And I'm sitting there thinking, would I have acted like, mm-hmm. would I have done that? And I'm thinking, no, I don't think so. Because either it was a critical situation where you ring the police straight away, or you wait for Garth to come back, because Garth's coming back in 2 hours anyway.
Right.
But in fact, he did the middle thing, which was ring Garth saying, "Garth, I've had a body." Garth says, "I'm coming back straight away," which he did do. So it just, when I heard that story, I thought there's more to this than meets the eye. Something's not right here. Now, it doesn't mean that those two were involved, but there's just something, there was enough in that conversation that made me think,
Right.
Let's start digging. And so I started digging at that.
So throughout the podcast has been, you kind of it's very similar to what we do on Truth and Justice, where you're out and kind of investigating and then chronicling what you're doing on the podcast as you move along. Have you made much progress over these years in investigating it and either identifying the body or getting a pool of suspects or anything?
All of those things. Okay. And the remarkable thing is that we had no expectation that we'd be able to do that because this had been the coldest, this is ice cold case.
Right.
I mean, this is permafrost in terms of cold cases. The police gave up on it decades ago. And all we had to go on was the story of the man who found it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we started. So when we now consider where we've got to, it's remarkable, really. So first thing we started to think about, you think about the two strands to this whole investigation. There's the who is he, which is the main thing. If we find out who he is, then chances of finding the perpetrators are much improved because you know the circle of friends, or a circle of acquaintances, maybe. So we were always looking at that, but we couldn't get away from this place where he was found was across a locked bridge where four people had the keys. It was on the land of a mill that people used to go onto, but no one else ever went on that piece of land. It was absolutely secluded. This is not a deposition that has taken place randomly. In order, the person who buried Fred knew that land intimately because you'd never find it unless you were intimately acquainted with it. Possible to find it from a road, or you'd, if the only other way onto that land was across a bridge and then to walk for about 40 minutes. Or maybe you could drive it actually, but you'd still have to drive for about 10 minutes. And if you were driving it for 10 minutes, you'd pass another 15 places which are just as good to bury a body. So the deposition site is absolutely critical in terms of the perpetrator. So when we were starting to investigate this, we were not only investigating who he is, but we're also looking at who had access to that land, who was around. So those two things were happening in tandem. And actually, we probably made more progress initially on who was around. Of course, we had David Nathan, we had Garth and Gopsall. They've got to be in that mix.
Right.
But also, through our investigations, we realized a serial killer was also living in the village. As a person who went on to kill probably more than 10 people was living in the village. And this village is no more than about 4,000 people.
Okay.
It's relatively small. But someone in that village went on to kill probably 10 people. Certainly we know he killed four people, and the police believe he killed many more. And he was 18 at the time. Now, the weird thing is, the person who ends up being the serial killer is probably not the person who did this. But he's, you know, he may have done, but the chances are it wasn't him. But he clearly was someone who we had to think about as well. The third person we had to think about was, when I was, I should preface this by saying this. One of the things that was done to the school is that it was given to a local university, Derby University, and they created a 3D image of the skull. And they also ran it through a series of tests and a series of systems, one of which was called CRANID, C-R-A-N-I-D, which was a huge database of craniums of skulls from around the world. And they put this skull through that system, and it would indicate the likely demographic of where that skull had come from. It's quite a reputable system. There are people who think it's not great, and there's been people who think it's fantastic, but it was certainly widely in use. And they ran this skull through there. And what came from that is that that skull probably, no, I should rephrase that, possibly came from Hungary or Denmark or the UK. Now, in 1969, 1970 in the UK, there was, it was a monoculture. Everybody was, you know, white Anglo-Saxon. Everybody was. There was no, very little integration of other communities at that point. So to find this, the university identifying a possible location of Hungary or Denmark was interesting because there weren't many about. But there was a Hungarian living next door to the site who had access, because he worked at the mill, to that piece of land. And that Hungarian, a man called Frank Kuhn, emigrated to Australia at the time of the murder. And we found his daughter, who lives now in the outback of Australia. That was an amazing find. She remembers everything about this time because she was 10 years old when she left Windsill. And Frank was desperate to leave, to go to another country. He applied for Canada, to go to Canada, South America, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. Australia was the first place that came forward and said, yeah, we'll accept you.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, really unexpectedly. So Frank Kuhn, a Hungarian man with a very interesting past, as we found out, ends up emigrating as far as away, as far away on the planet as you can get from Windsor, at exactly the right time that this body would have been found. So suddenly, we've got David Nathan, Gotham Gopsel, we've got Anthony Hardy, the serial killer, we've got Frank Kuhn, the Hungarian who emigrates in a rush. And then finally, we find someone called Matthew James Jackson, who, not a nice man at all, who tends to go missing when things go bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up living in Frank Kuhn's house right next door to where this body was found, and he goes missing. And he dies much later, so we tracked him down. But he has the tendency of disappearing when he's done bad things.
Mm-hmm.
We see that elsewhere. And he goes missing around the same time as this body would have been killed. So suddenly, from nowhere, we end up with five potential perpetrators. And a good part of the work we've done over the course of the last 4 years has been digging into these potential perpetrators. So we've done a ton of work on that and got a long way with the perpetrators. But of course, it can't be all five. It's one of them, or maybe two of them
who are involved in.
But we have also made significant progress in terms of potential victim. We have a potential victim in our sight at the moment. I'd probably say that the chances of it being him are no more than about 20%. But, you know, in a 50-year-old case, 20% chances are, you don't get many of them.
Right.
You've got to chase those down. So this man matches many of the physical characteristics of Fred. So I should say about Fred, he had some very unusual characteristics. We know his height. He was like 5'7". He was very slim. The wedding ring he wore on his right hand was a woman's wedding ring. Now, it was a plain band, but it was a woman's size. Now, you know, if I took my wife's wedding ring, I wouldn't get it near any of my fingers.
Right, me too.
So that gives you an idea of how slim this man's hands were. So he was very slim. He had short hair. 1969, not many people had short hair. I remember 69. I remember my family in 69. All the younger men that come in the 20s and 30s, they had quite long hair by 69.
Mm-hmm.
And would have been the same in the States. So, but he had short hair and he had fair ginger hair. He also, one of the things that was commented on by the coroner in the UK, he was the person who administers the death, if you like, was that his hands were not the hands of someone used to manual labor. This was a man who had probably a sedentary occupation. So he wasn't a lumberjack.
Right.
He was working in an office somewhere. So we know all those physical attributes of him. We also know that he had quite unusual dentistry. And dentistry, which was done only 6 months before his death, and quite extensive dentistry. He also showed, and this only came out much later, maybe signs of some kind of neck or shoulder issue, something called torticollis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's known about the body, factually. So when we look for missing people, we can easily rule most people out because the hair color is wrong, or the hair length is wrong, or the height's wrong, or the build is wrong, or all these things. Or he was a lumberjack. It's not really him.
Yeah.
That's it. So we rule out all these people, but there was one person we could never rule out. And this was a man who lived on the Isle of Man, which is a tiny island off England. Now, one of the things the police did do, to their credit, was they went to all the dentists in the UK and all the dental exhibitions and all the dental authorities and showed this unusual dentistry. No one identified the teeth. Now, which is weird, because if I'm in a plane crash, I'm going to get identified through my dental record. So will you. So will everybody listening to this.
Right.
But they couldn't identify him through dental records, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
So, and nobody claimed him. So he's unnamed and he's unclaimed. Nobody's coming forward saying, have you seen my brother, cousin, wife, and sorry, husband, work colleague? No one reported him missing. So one of the things that interested us was he from a part of the UK where the reach of this investigation never got to?
Right.
And one of those places is a tiny little island between the UK and Ireland called the Isle of Man. And one option is a man that went missing from the Isle of Man on the 1st of February, 1969. A man called John Gick is his name. G-I-C-K. He was a scoutmaster. He was a gay man, which in the Isle of Man was illegal until the 1990s. So he led a very, very quiet, he led a double life. So. But John Gick meets all the physical criteria. So he was 5'8". He was very thin, and we've seen pictures and compared pictures to the reconstruction of the time, and they're very, very similar. He had fair, short hair. He worked in something called the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company, which is the company that ran the ferries from the Isle of Man to the UK. He was an accountant there. He was an accounts clerk there. And so he had the height, he had the build, he had the hair, he had the hair length, he had the hair color, he had the sedentary occupation. He went missing on the 1st of February, 1969. So now his dentistry, we don't know because I haven't got access to John Gick's dental records. We've seen pictures of it. Could be okay. Could, you know, we're not certain about
it. Mm-hmm.
But everything else stacks up. So, and there are some very odd things. So I'll give you a very odd thing that potentially could tie him in. We don't think John Gick died on the day he went missing because a work colleague saw him 3 months later.
Okay.
So chances are he didn't die then. So he was still alive. But if you were going to go missing out of choice, and I think John Gick stepped away from his old life because, and we can get into reasons why, but essentially he was about to be exposed as a gay man on an island where it was illegal.
Uh-huh.
And he was working with Boy Scouts.
Okay.
You know, it's not a great place to find yourself. So, but his name is John Gick, but his mother's name was quite an unusual name, which was Farger, F-A-R-G-H-E-R. Quite a common name in the Isle of Man, not common at all in the rest of England. So one of the things we thought about was whether any Fargers, family name, in Burton at the time, because that would link John Gick to Burton in some way. Maybe, maybe he adopted his mother's maiden name and forget, because John Gick is a very uncommon name as well. Maybe he adopted a different name, Farger. So we found a Farger in Burton. There's only one. There's very few in the UK, in England. And that Farger happened to marry the sister of David Nathan, who found the body.
I'm connecting dots in my head here.
That's, John Chit, the other man.
Yeah, yeah.
His mother's maiden name is Farga.
Right.
There is one Farga in Burton, and that Farga in Burton happened to marry the sister of David Nathan, who originally found Fred. So there is a potential link, not only between John Jick, the man who goes missing from the Isle of Man, to Burton upon Trent, there's a potential link that links John Jick from the Isle of Man to the deposition site. So there is interesting evidence to suggest that John Jick could be involved as the victim. The chances are not, they can't be 90% yet, because we've not done the DNA thing on it. Because we can't do that stuff in the UK like you can in the US. And the police aren't allowed to do it. So we think there's about a 15 to 20% chance that John Jick could be the body, but you know, there's a load more work to do on it. But we're making, so it's a long answer to your original question. Have you made any progress on it in 48 episodes? We've made a ton of progress on it in 48 episodes, and we'll probably make a ton more in the next 48. You know, the police, with all their resources, have not been able to solve this in 53 years. Us, with no resources, have got a lot further in the 4 or 5 years we've been working on.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're making incredible progress on it, and it'd be really interesting to find out, because the thing that's kind of baffles me about the whole thing, and I'm sure you too, is how could there not be, whoever's missing, someone should have reported him missing. So it seems very likely this John guy may be the victim, or that they must have come from outside of the UK. Have you considered that possibility?
Yeah. They are the two possibilities, really. I don't think he's from the UK. Now, I should say that experience has taught me, I'm not associated with the police in any way, but you know, I do talk to them a lot about it. You know, it wasn't a joined up police force in 1971. It wasn't in the UK. There were independent police forces doing their own thing. I have no great confidence that if a man went missing in Wales or in a region of England, you know, 300 miles away from Burton, I have no real confidence that that person would have been properly investigated, because there was no computers at work then.
Mm-hmm.
It was all on pieces of paper. So easy to slip through the cracks in that process, or through the gaps in the net. I'll give you a real example of that. The police got quite excited about 6 years ago that they thought that a person who matched the dental records from Wales went missing. Wales is only 200 yards away, 200 miles away from them. Not even that, 150 miles away. So the police got excited about that about 6 years ago, because they thought the dental records matched and the guy had gone missing. They did a DNA test on him and it wasn't him. But what that does prove is that there were people that were going missing in 1969, 1970, only 150 miles away, that were not picked up in the original dental search. Because this guy was never picked up in the original dental search. It was only 45 years later that someone said, hey, maybe you should check this guy. So whilst it is likely that whoever this person was came from either a distant part of England or the UK, like an island, or from outside the UK, Hungary being a good example.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a chance he was from the UK and the police system broke down. To be different today, but
right.
You know, 1971, it was pens and paper.
Yeah. Even here in the United States, you know, there was a lot of the most prolific serial killers existed during that time, even up into the 80s. because the law enforcement agencies across states, even across cities at some places, weren't communicating. So someone, all they had to do was just, they could murder somebody and then, you know, move 100 miles away and do it again. And nobody ever knew that the two were connected.
I think that's very similar. But it's quite important in terms of our investigative process, in the sense of we don't dismiss people from England.
Right.
Because, you know, if we identify someone from England who happens to meet those physical characteristics, it could still be them.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't a million people going missing in England.
Right.
I mean, one of the great things about England, you know, we don't have guns. We certainly didn't then. We don't now. But, you know, people aren't being murdered left, right, and center. They're just not being murdered in the numbers you imagine.
Right.
Back in 71, there was probably 20 in the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be relatively easy, and people are not going missing all the time. So, and those people who are going missing, it's in the papers. You can find them.
Right.
And you can eliminate them. And we've just been going through a long period of process of that elimination over years and years. And that's one of the things that John Jick came from, because we found a person who disappeared. And the more we looked into him, the more we became concerned, not convinced, concerned, that he could have a relationship case.
Right. Well, this is fascinating, and I'm excited to catch up and then see where you go from here. Before I let you go, I got a couple questions from the chat I wanted to throw at you. Colin, it is back to kind of the beginning when we were talking about Nathan David when he found the body and the weird call to his friend to come back, and he wondered, is it possible they could have expected to find like Viking treasure or something like that? Is that a thing? You know, if you find a body, that there may be something else that they may be excited about discovering.
He could have done. I think it's a possibility. I don't think it really kind of justifies. He could have waited for 2 hours in that scenario. You know what I mean? No one
right.
else could have gone in that. You know, he didn't have to. He hadn't found anything treasure worthy.
Right.
This person wasn't wearing anything like that. The skull that he'd uncovered at that point gave no indication for that. No one else was about to go on that piece of land for the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if there was any danger in waiting for him, for Garth to naturally come back from his meeting.
Right.
I don't think it was that. This strikes to me a little bit panicky.
Mm-hmm.
There's a panic involved in this. The more I thought about it over the years, and I got to know David very well, and you know, weird things happen with that. You know, when he died, as he died about 6 months ago, one of his best friends rang me and said, "Ken, there's something David wanted you to know. There's something that he'd never told anyone, not even in the police stuff, that he wanted you to know." And that was. There was another aspect to the discovery story that he'd never told, which was that this is what he told me. I happen not to believe it, which is the weird thing. David Nathan on his deathbed says, "I've got a confession to make to you, Ken, but I don't believe it." But what he said was that they used to shoot at it across the river with live ammunition
mm-hmm.
from the workshop that they had, and you could. Hi.
Are you still seeing me? Everything looks fine.
I can't see you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I hear you and see you. I don't know.
Well, I don't know what happened there, but for some reason that just disappeared. If you can still hear me, I can see you.
Yep.
Sorry about that. So he said we used to shoot across the river with live ammunition. Now, he'd never told the police that.
Mm-hmm.
He never told anyone that. But actually, there were no bullets found at this skull site. There was no damage to the skull. And these people were only 30 yards away, and they're supposed to be cracked shots. They wouldn't have missed.
Mm-hmm.
What was he telling me? Because what he was telling me was provably untrue. But why did he feel the need to ring me literally the week before he died, knowing he was dying, to say, I didn't tell the truth? I've just got a feeling there's more to that, and I haven't been able to work it out yet. Why did he make that call? Was it that there was something more than that that's on his mind, and he couldn't quite bring himself to tell me the true story?
I wonder if a possibility could be that if there was like an accidental thing. Is that what he's trying to, like, maybe he's shooting and then accidentally hit this guy?
There was absolutely no injuries to the body.
So there was enough flesh left on the body that they could tell that?
Yeah. No injuries. No bone damage. When the coroner recorded an open verdict, means, which is really legalese for we've got no idea.
Right.
But they think probably asphyxiation.
Wow. Yeah. Probably all they have left, they can rule out everything else.
But not asphyxiation through strangulation, because there was no damage to the vocal cords or anything like that. So it's literally a bag over the head, maybe, or drowning.
Right.
Or some kind of, or maybe in a place where that person's ability to breathe was significantly restricted.
Wow. That's fascinating. Last question I want to hit before I let you go. Kind of a two-parter from Mischief in the chat. She wants to know, she said, what you mentioned earlier, that in the UK you can't do DNA testing like you can do here in the United States. She wants to know why there can't be DNA testing done. And then also, because in modern days, it would be great if they had a DNA profile from them to do a genetic genealogy search of it.
Yeah, and they can't. It's illegal. It's illegal in the UK for the police to use genealogy websites for any DNA purposes.
Wow.
Okay. So that's,
do they have his DNA, though? Have they? Yeah.
They have mitochondrial DNA, which is useful in the sense of, if we can find someone who we can identify a family member, they can check against that to see if there's a match from a DNA perspective. That's what they did with the guy in Wales.
Uh-huh.
So they've gone through anything they've got in the police records. There's no record of him.
Mm-hmm.
But they need someone like me to find for them a family member of someone who's gone missing,
mm-hmm,
that they could check against. That's the only way of using DNA in this case. Now, John Jick, who we mentioned earlier, we've also found the only people who carry his DNA in the UK. There are two people. And we've told the police who they are and where they are. Whether the police will do anything about it, I don't know. The police have a habit of not doing anything about it in this case.
Wow. Well, this is absolutely fascinating, and I'm excited, like I said, to see where the journey goes. But I want to thank you for taking time. And we were off the air. Ken mentioned that he's moving houses, he's in temporary offices, he's bouncing around. So I appreciate you taking an hour to chat with us today.
No, I love talking about it. As you can probably tell, Bob, I do. Yeah. It's something that's become a big part of what I do and of my life. And it's introduced me to millions of people that I would never known anyway. We have a big Facebook network who get very involved. A little bit like what you guys do in the sense of, because it's real time,
mm-hmm,
because I'm investigating and giving forward my discoveries as they happen, people actually have a role to play.
Right.
People can say, but Ken, what about this? And that can figure something, that can trigger something that I can go away and work on, or we can go away and work. So it's just been an amazing journey from that perspective. So if anybody wants to find the podcast, it's The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head. Anybody wants to find the Facebook group, it's The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head. The podcast is the Facebook group. And, I'm there all the time answering questions as often as I can.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it. Hopefully you get a bunch of our listeners come in and help out too. That's our deal. They're all pitching in trying to help, and so you get some new eyes helping you out, hopefully.
Well, Bob, that would be great. The more people who know about it, the better chance we've got. And I'm a big believer in that. And you know, continue the great work you're doing. I'm a big fan of long-form investigative podcasts in this, and there's so few of them. I mean, most of the true crime stuff I listen to is, you know, essentially just Wikipedia and a different one the next week.
Mm-hmm.
That's not investigative journalism. What you guys do, what I think we're doing, that's, I think, really where the game is.
I agree. And with that, I will let you go. Thank you so much for coming on, and good luck with your continued investigation.
Thanks, Bob. Great to meet all your listeners as well. Thanks very much indeed.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.